So I always describe EFF as a tech legal advocacy organization. How do you guys describe it to like your non-lawyer, non-tech friends or family members who maybe have a vague understanding of what the EFF is?
I generally say that we make sure that when you go online, your rights go with you. And that specifically we focus in on your privacy and on your free speech rights and on the right to be able to build interesting stuff that other people can use, which is something the internet has really enabled. You know, in terms of impact litigation online, there's EFF and then there's ACLU and then there's the whole rest of the world doing awful things. So we could have 10 more organizations doing what we do and we still wouldn't be able to keep up. So, you know,
now that you are the executive director, how do you see the organization today in 2015 as different from when you came aboard? Do you feel like its focus is different? Do you feel like the threats are different? Do you feel like there are cases now that the EFF wouldn't have taken 10 or 15 or 20 years ago? How do you see those things as being different?
Well, I think the biggest difference is that the whole world now uses the tools that when I started at EFF were kind of a smaller cadre of people who used and rely on the tools. So to a certain extent, I think the world has come to us rather than us changing all that much. But with the world coming to us, we've grown a lot. We just have a lot more capacity. So there are cases we can take on that we couldn't have taken on when I started. You know, I started full-time at EFF in 2000. My first case working with the EFF was about 1994. I think our basic philosophy hasn't changed very much. We're still generally very nimble, very small. We have to look for creative ways to try to bring issues to attention because we can't just engage in, you know, on the litigation side, there are people who engaged in scorched earth litigation to try to make their agendas forward. We don't have those resources and we never will. So we still have to think nimbly. We have to think, okay, what's the quickest way we can bring this thing? What's the kind of case that will get us to the issues that we think are most important the most quickly? How do we run an activism campaign that takes advantage of us being kind of smaller often than our adversaries, as opposed to one where we're really, you know, owning the space? So I don't think that those things have changed very much, but we do have a wider range of tools because of our size. You know, we now have an activism department. When I started at EFF, we had one activist. Now we have five or six people who keep the blog moving, keep the Twitter feed moving, put together action campaigns and make us a much bigger force in those campaigns than we were a long time ago. We're in the midst of arguing the cryptography wars all over again. So, you know, we published a blog post yesterday that basically summarizes the same arguments that I was making in the 90s about why government regulation on crypto is a really bad idea. I think we do it a little better now. We're a little more polished in what we do, but the arguments, frankly, you know, the government's doing the same thing. So the arguments about why it's stupid haven't changed either. When we were talking about crypto in the 90s, we were talking about the future. We were talking about when a lot of people come online, they're going to need privacy. When people start doing financial transactions online, they're going to need privacy. When we live in an internet-worked world, you know, we're going to be doing things differently than we do in a world where most people's activities that are personal and private occur just in their own house. Trying to explain, you know, what was going to happen when there were servers and you were, you know, your mail was held on a server, was really hard to do in the 90s. It's really easy to do now. People have Gmail. They understand that their mail doesn't sit on their computers. It sits on Google servers, and that, you know, their idea that just because you use Gmail doesn't mean you've waived all your privacy or Fourth Amendment rights is obvious to so many people now. It was something that we had to explain before, and we don't have to explain that piece anymore. There's still stuff to explain. So I do think that the biggest difference is now, in some ways, the consequences of what the government is trying to do are bigger because we're all more reliant on these technologies. But explaining why it's a problem has actually become a little easier than it was.
Are there cases that sort of stick out in your mind as being the, I don't know, best cases, most funnest cases, most worthwhile case, like ones that really stick out over the others? You know, your top five playlist or whatever. You know, that you feel like have had the most impact during your time here.
Well, obviously, the first one is the Bernstein case, which is the case that brought me to EFF, but also that, you know, where we establish that computer programs are protected speech for purposes of the First Amendment, and that the government's regulation on cryptography was an improper scheme. I think that case was seminal, you know, for me personally, but I also think it was seminal in people thinking about the internet as a place largely of speech, and that the tools that we use on the internet are themselves speech as well. And so that's been, and that people deserve the strongest tools that they can get when it comes to their own privacy. You know, we took the Grokster case to the Supreme Court. That was an important moment. We were able to save the secondary liability arguments and contributory and vicarious liability claims that were there. The Supreme Court created a third kind of liability called inducement liability, which wasn't what we wanted. But I do think it's shaken out pretty well in terms of people's ability to use, to have access to systems where they can share information freely. You know, the copyright wars kind of continue, but I think that was an important battle. And had we actually lost it in the way that the entertainment industries wanted us to lose it, we'd live in a different technological society now. There would be tools that we all rely on right now that wouldn't have been able to exist. So that was important. I think that we got the national security letter statute declared unconstitutional a year ago. That's up in front of the Ninth Circuit, and we're waiting for a decision. But that prompted Congress to basically implement some changes to that statute that don't go all the way to where we need it to go for the First Amendment, but that are far better than what the law looked like before. So I think we spurred some changes there. You know, I think our national security cases, the Hepting versus AT&T case that Congress then passed a law to block, and then Juul versus NSA that followed on, have been tremendously important. Inside the courtroom, I think we've done a few things, but we've really been, you know, the government's foot dragging techniques have been successful. But, you know, it was that litigation campaign that I think helped spur Mr. Snowden into action to try to make sure that the world understood what was going on with regard to our global networks turning into surveillance networks. And he's been pretty clear about that. It's a great honor and a great responsibility now to try to take the work that he's done and turn it into some lasting change. And we got a baby step of that with USA Freedom, but there's so much more to do nationally, domestically and internationally. So I think if we hadn't done those cases and we hadn't kept pursuing them when nobody was paying any attention whatsoever from 2006 on, we might still be having the conversations we're having today, but I think they played a role, and they played a role in, both for Mr. Snowden personally and for people across the world in recognizing that we were right, and that these are important conversations to have. Frankly, Eric Holder just said yesterday about how important these conversations were for us to have. So I feel pretty, happy that we saw those through. There were a few years where it felt like nobody cared about that. I used to call these cases my white whale. the EFF chasing the NSA and trying to get the NSA to stop surveilling everybody was something we were doing in relative obscurity when very few people were paying attention. Now the whole world is paying attention, and that's great. But I do think that our persistence in that had a role to play.
What is it like for you? So I've seen you argue a couple of the Juul hearings in Oakland. And you did a very admirable job. But one of the things that I've remarked on this whole process, and I don't know the Juul case nearly as well as you do, obviously, but it strikes me that with a case like Juul, it's been dragging on for so many years. And, you know, there's been some minor kind of procedural, opinions and such that have been issued. But, like, the meat of the case is still there. And so that's good for the EFF, because that means that, you know, that can continue to be argued and decided and so forth. But as you know, the surveillance continues and grows and gets more sophisticated, and, you know, the world keeps turning. And so I, like, is it as frustrating for you guys as lawyers as it is for us as non-lawyers to be like, what the hell is taking so long? Like, is that, or do you just kind of expect that and that just comes with the territory?
Well, I'd say go back and forth. I certainly have days where I'm like, oh my God, please just make a decision here, you know, and I get frustrated with the pace of things. And I get frustrated with the government arguing and re-arguing and re-arguing the same thing. I mean, we have briefed the state secrets privilege and whether it bars our case, I think at least 8 times in front of the district court and the court of appeals. That argument has never won them anything significant, but they just don't give up. And so, you know, they really get to play out the clock in a way that is tremendously frustrating. On the other hand, have you ever tried to pass a law? I mean, how many years?
I have not.
No. But I mean, how many years did it take before we got even the healthcare law we got that I think is a gigantic change, but not at all what the people on the cutting edge of where healthcare ought to be would be a single payer kind of idea. That took, you know, how many presidents? You know, Clinton tried and failed. And, you know, so, you know, the truth is the pace of real change in this country is slow. And our system, there's good arguments to be made that our system was set up so that the pace would be slow. I think in the national security context, it's especially slow because the political branches and the judiciary are a little nervous about telling the national security professionals, you know, no, you can't do this. So, yes, I get frustrated, but then I sit down and start working on the next brief, right? Because real change is hard. So we're a couple years in. We've got a lot to do, but we've got some changes. And, you know, some of the biggest changes are the, you know, the changes that people are building more security tools than they've ever built. We're securing, you know, EFF's tech team is a huge part of this. We're securing the internet. Anyway, we are, you know, we have HTTPS everywhere. We have the observatory, the SSL observatory, where we're watching for bad certs. And we're doing pretty gigantic technical projects, but we're not alone. I mean, people are building, you know, I've got, you know, tools on my phone that let me do secure communications. I've got, you know, secure messaging that actually works. You know, we've, you know, Tor's been around for a long time, but it was, you know, both distressing and heartening to see that the NSA can't break Tor, and it's frustrating the hell out of them. I actually think that our tax dollars should not be spent attacking American technologies, that it's a misuse of our money, that they ought to be helping us build better secure technologies, not trying to attack or undermine ours. But it was still nice to see that they haven't been able to, that the math works. You know, Bruce Schneier, my board member, says trust the math, and so far the math works. And more people are engaged in trying to take the mathematical principles that work and make them usable for ordinary people now than ever before. And I have been trying to get strong crypto in the everyday tools that people use since 1993. There are more people engaged in that endeavor now than ever before. And that's really heartening.
With respect to the surveillance, I mean, I feel like, you know, I spent a couple years living in Germany working as a journalist, and it seems to me that in the U.S. we have a very different mindset than people do in Germany and maybe other parts of Europe as well with respect to kind of how companies and governments operate, particularly with respect to privacy and surveillance. I feel like that here in the U.S., we as a society allow our law enforcement and our government agencies to do whatever it is that they think that they should do to do their job to the best of their ability until someone tells them to stop doing that. Whereas I feel like in Europe, or in many parts of Europe, it's kind of the opposite, where, you know, a government agency says, okay, well, we need authorization to do this, or, you know, is it legal for us to do that, or something like that. Whereas here, you know, we have not just big stuff like the NSA and you know, all the stuff that came out of Snowden, but little stuff like license plate readers, you know, on, you know, Oakland police cars and San Francisco police cars and things like that. Like, nobody, you know, I feel like it's just like, oh yeah, here's this stuff, go use it, go catch bad guys, go do your job, you know? And then it only comes out, you know, months or years later through advocacy from EFF and others, to tell people like me and other people that this sort of stuff exists, you know, and then there maybe are legal challenges, and yet it sort of continues. And so I feel like it's like, to me, it's almost like a Sisyphean battle in a way, you know, like it just doesn't end.
Well, I think that the tension between law enforcement wanting to do everything that they possibly can do, and law and the public having to say no, like these are tools that you can't have because they're too problematic, is as old as the country, right? I mean, the whole, you know, there's an argument that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights is all about saying no to law enforcement and government. It's all about limits on what they can do. So I do think that you're right to a certain extent that it's not going to be over in terms of things. But we can make great strides and take things off limits, right? But I think that since September 11th, this problem that law enforcement has access to a gigantic array of tools that they get to just deploy and then we find out about them later, I think that's actually a relatively new problem, and it comes along with the secrecy that we've seen since September 11th. And the I think that we do need to try to regain control of the process by which law enforcement gets access to new technologies so that we have a window into it and a chance to say yes or no earlier. We're starting to see this. We're seeing local, you know, boards of supervisors suddenly raise this thing and start to really talk about this.
But that strikes me as the exception rather than the rule as of now.
I think we need to change the course. I mean, you know, one of the things that we're going to try to do and one of our big campaigns coming up is going against overclassification. But I think that's just a piece of the overall secrecy problems that we have with regard to not just national security, as you point out. I mean, this is one of the truisms, right? I mean, if it starts with a fancy national security program, within 5 years, it's going to be something the cop on the beat gets to use for almost all of this stuff. We're seeing it for far more than I would have anticipated, frankly, the telephone records stuff that we're seeing local and state law enforcement get access to is really scary. And a little surprising, because part of what the, you know, national security people will tell you is, well, trust us, you know, we're just a small cadre. We have a small agenda, small, not small in importance, but, you know, we're looking for terrorists and money launderers. We're not looking for common drug dealers and stuff like that. Well, the truth is this stuff has all flowed down to, you know, all the way.
Looking forward to the next, you know, dare I say, 25 years, are there issues that kind of lurk in the back of your brain, you know, or that keep you up at night? A thing that I wonder about, having written a little bit about license plate reader stingrays and some of the more locally used surveillance, I wonder, like, you know, in 3 or 5 years, are we going to be talking about common, high quality, sophisticated facial recognition that, you know, now we're starting to see police officers wearing body cameras. It seems to me it's not very far off the day when those cameras are a hell of a lot smaller and contain very good facial recognition. And so I wonder then, you know, what does that world look like? Or what does the world look like when, excuse me, when cops routinely pick up, you know, your hair that you drop on the street and start running your DNA through databases? And I imagine a near future where everybody's DNA is in some government database at birth. Do those kinds of things like enter into your mind as you look forward to you know, future cases that the EFF would work on?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's true that the pace of technology to surveil us and, you know, the ability for those various data streams to get merged, right? I mean, it's the aggregation of data that is really very difficult right now for the law to grapple with. The law tends to look at, what about this technique? You know, what about, you know, DNA matching, and not really looking at, when you add that to other techniques, what that could do. Same with facial recognition. They look at facial recognition as if it's a single thing. But, of course, when you add facial recognition to the database of all the transactions you've done, to where you've ever been, to what you've ever do, you end up creating a really persistent profile about people. So we do worry about that. I think it's important that we have this ongoing conversation, that we continue to try to figure out what's going on and then talk about whether it's legal or not. The law is going to trail technology. I'd love it if it didn't. To a certain, you know, I'd love to be able to run into court the first time the first time that, you know, if, you know, law enforcement had to go to the Supreme Court and get an advisory opinion about whether this new technology was appropriately deployed. That would be kind of a, there's ways in which that would be good. There's ways in which it would be troubling, right? Because you do want You want space for innovation. And I want law enforcement to be able to be innovative as well. There are countries that have like constitutional courts, right, that handle things separate on a separate track from when they come up in cases. I don't see us changing into that system anytime soon. So while it might be a fun exercise to think about the pros and cons of that, EFF, we tend to be pretty practical. So I do worry that the ability to surveil is so far ahead of our ability to figure out how to build regulatory structures around it as to be problematic for people. But I do think that eventually the law catches up. And regulations and people's opinions catch up, and so I think that this is the endeavor we're in, right? John Perry Barlow told me a long time ago that rights are something you go out and claim. They're not something that just naturally happen. And so we're in the that's my job, is to go out and help people claim their rights. And this idea that you passively sit back and these things are bestowed upon you isn't consistent with the history of our country, or I would argue the world. But part of the reason I decided to do it is because I not only think EFF is more important than it's ever been, because the world cares about the issues that we care about now at a greater degree than they ever have, and because the number of people who are recognizing that we do need to step up and protect this digital world is greater than it's ever been. But because I think we're part of a movement now, that there are a lot of organizations, there are a lot of people who care about this stuff, and I'd like to see the digital rights movement start thinking about how to exercise its power and how to begin to really be a force that I think it's worthy of now. I think there are enough people, there's enough caring people deeply. SOPA and PIPA, stopping SOPA and PIPA was a moment where the internet realized that if it rose up and said no, they would actually happen. I think USA Freedom was another moment where the people who care about our digital worlds were able to stand up and actually pass something affirmative. Not just stop something bad, but actually build something that's good. Not as good as I'd want, believe me. Do not get me wrong about this. It was a baby step. But, prior to USA Freedom, prior to June of this year, the only other time that Congress has ever said no to the national security infrastructure of the United States was 1978. And before that, never, right? Twice in history. Have those people, the people who run the NSA, ever been told, no, you can't do this? And we helped make the second one happen, we meaning the whole internet community. So as I think about where we are in time, I think we're building a movement, and I think we need to start thinking about how to build a movement that is strong and robust and that makes it basically impossible to suggest things that might hurt the internet. Where do we go for the next 25 years? I think in the next 25 years, I would like EFF to be just as vibrant as it is now, but just as vibrant as a part of a constellation of organizations and other, individuals and other things that are really making sure that our, this new connected world that we live in protects our privacy, protects our free speech, and creates space for innovation.
Very good. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks.